You are now tuning in to the Own the Build podcast. Join C-Link's very own Paul Hemming, where each week he interviews experts from the world of construction and asks all the important questions around intelligent construction management.
Hello and welcome to episode 153 of the Own the Build podcast with me, Paul Hemming. Today, I am again sharing an invitation to tender template in the show notes. Imagine your supply chain is pre-qualified, your subcontractors are selected for each trade package, you are ready to issue tender documents. We have created an invitation to tender template, which is customizable for your project, and it will really improve the format in which you're presenting to subbies. If you want to digitize it, if you don't want to be so old school, you can do that entirely through our procurement platform, C-Link. I'd be really happy to show anybody that, so feel free just to reach out for a demo in the show notes as well. Enough about that. In the studio today, I am joined by Anil Sahani, Director of the Infrastructure Sector at the RICS. Anil leads the emerging RICS initiative and strategy on placing and positioning the institution within the field of excellent commercial management of projects. You know I'm loving this already. Globally, with a primary focus on infrastructure sector. Anil, I am very, very happy to have you on the show. How are you today?
Paul, I'm doing wonderful. It's a high honor to really have a chat with you. I waited for this for some time. I'm glad the day has arrived.
No, excellent. Likewise, I have waited for it for some time. And anybody who is championing excellent commercial management of projects is someone who I know I'm going to enjoy speaking to. And I think just before we hit record today, Anil, you said to me you were 20 miles from the White House. Is that right?
Approximately as the crow flies, yes.
Excellent. And so do you work in and around Washington, D.C. then?
I do. I'm primarily a home-based worker for RICS as a staff member. I do go out for meetings, travel to meet members and other industry experts, but largely a home-based worker.
Okay, nice. And so today we're going to talk about where is the data to decarbonize the built environment. And again, for all of our lovely listeners, if you go to the show notes where there is so much for you, you can get a demo of Seal, you can get the invitation to tender template, and you will also be able to see Anil's article, which he's kindly written for us on that topic. That is what we're going to talk about today, Anil, and I'm looking forward to getting to that. Before we do, would you be able to just paint a picture, really, of your career's journey in construction up to this point?
Absolutely. So I have, you can call, a pretty interesting background in terms just of locations at where I have worked. I started my journey, became a construction engineer in New Delhi, India, and then as my friends say, took the wrong decision of doing a PhD in construction and moved to Canada.
Why do they say that?
I think they're just trying to pull my leg, but I think it was a wonderful decision personally for me. I spent 3 years in Canada doing some research in the construction project management area. And then I obviously, after finishing PhD, having worked in the sector, I took on various roles, including teaching as a professor in the U.S. and also consulting, advisory, and other kinds of activities. During my tenure here in the U.S., I became very deeply involved with what's called production home building in the U.S. I lived in a city where they were building 75,000 single-family, some people call them McMansions, but single-family homes. I really understood the trades, the subcontractors, their workflows, and work practices. And having gained that firsthand experience, I decided to start my own sort of a tech startup when this wasn't even a fashionable term to use. I created a core product which helped automate some of the back-end work that a subcontractor, perhaps let's say a concreting subcontractor on a single-family home construction, doing 15,000 units a year. So we did a lot of automation, tracking, scheduling, and other commercial and project management aspects. So that helped me a lot. Simultaneously, I also worked as a technical consultant to the World Bank under their international comparison program, where you essentially come up with mechanisms of comparing construction costs across various countries, various regions, which, as per The Economist, is a pretty tricky situation because construction is apparently a comparison-resistant sector. So I've worked in India, I've worked in Australia, I've worked in the UK, Canada, and the US. And now in my current role, I'm a member of the RICS, a fellow, as well as staff of the RICS. I have a great fortune of talking to our members globally who are at the bleeding edge, cutting edge, really doing a lot of wonderful stuff, especially quantity surveyors and construction project managers.
Oh, yeah, you've got to be nice to quantity surveyors. Absolutely. We're all listening, and we were waiting for you to give us a pat on the back there.
Absolutely. About 35 to 40% of our membership is quantity surveyors. So I'm extremely passionate about promoting what QSs do.
100%. And there's plenty of them listening right now. And I am equally as passionate about, you know, shouting about what we do and why we're so important. I think as you said, you started that little segment there by saying it's been quite an interesting journey. And absolutely it has. It seems like you've covered quite a lot. I know that you're a construction tech enthusiast. Maybe we'll talk about that later. One of the things that stuck out to me there was what you said about when you decided to do a PhD in construction, your friends teased you for it. What is the element of teasing? Is it because it's construction?
Not really. I think some of my friends were non-construction, not in non-engineering as well. The statement most people make is he was a smart guy, then he decided to do a PhD. So I think there's more fun than
on the PhD, not the sector.
Yeah. Maybe at that time, and I don't want to date myself, but at that time it was still considered something that you did if you were passionate about. But I think today, if you had a PhD, you could do so much in maybe artificial intelligence, doing more research on carbon and low carbon materials. So I think that statement no longer holds true.
Okay, excellent. And then the other thing that just stuck out to me that I wanted to ask you about was, and you didn't mention the city that you're working, but you're talking about production house building in the US. And you mentioned 75,000 houses being built. Over what period was that 75,000 houses were being built?
This was annual production in the greater Phoenix area.
Annual
greater Phoenix area, one large area with many jurisdictions. There are little towns, suburbs, each with their own building controls departments. But yes, that's the range.
And was it achieved, 75,000 homes?
Absolutely. At that time, this was before the, again, this will date me, but this is the previous housing bubble burst in the US. I'm talking about 2005, 2006, 2007 time frame.
Okay. No, it's really interesting because, you know, here in the UK, we're busy trying to deliver somewhere between, depending on who you listen to and which government's in, but for the last, I don't know, 10-15 years, been trying to deliver between 225,000 and 350,000 new homes per year, and to put it bluntly, failing absolutely miserably at it in terms of like the consistency. We just can't do it, and it's forever plaguing us as an economy on so many different levels. Do you have any reflections on that? I know you said you've worked a little bit in the UK, you've worked across the world, really. You know, is there anything that we should be learning from the fact that, you know, 75,000 homes in one area, if you like, one region in the Greater Phoenix region, you were saying, and that I said, did they deliver that? Because obviously I come from a background of seeing us miss on those targets. Is there anything that you think is really a takeaway that we should be considering here in the UK?
I've seen this across. Housing has been one area, especially affordable housing, that I've worked in quite a bit, even including India. It's simple and complex at the same time. If you were to just look at one unit at a time, it's pretty simple for construction folks to build that. But see, it's really when it starts integrating with land, with the volumes, with the trade base, because it's like a factory. If you just looked at the Greater Phoenix area, it was like a factory with all trades and subcontractors running around in the city. In fact, we did a study to see traveling between construction sites for one subcontractor's team may involve like 50 to 75 miles of just driving around the city to go to various work sites. I think, I mean, obviously there are issues with production home building in the US as well. But I think it's the market forces that really drive construction, the demand for housing, and perhaps a little bit more streamlined regulatory process compared to the UK is what I would say is easier in the US.
In terms of that the initial like planning system to get.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think there'll be lots of people listening saying, don't get us started on the UK planning system, particularly right now. It's a bit of a pickle. But anyway, okay, no, it's really, really interesting. Thank you for sharing your story so far. So you wrote the article, as I mentioned earlier, for us, which is titled, Where is the Data to Decarbonize the Built Environment? Question number one from me on that topic is, and you're smiling, so I'm pleased, is can I ask what it was that inspired you to even think about penning this article?
Sure. So let me give you a cheeky answer first. I knew if I said, where are the QSs in the decarbonization journey? You probably would have disinvited me. So therefore, I think I said, where is the data for decarbonization? What I really want to say is, I think decarbonization is a problem that requires all upstream, downstream experts in the construction value chain to participate in. Let's pick the example of QSs. QSs are brilliant with the cost management process, right? We know how when there is limited information, limited data upfront in a project, how do you benchmark, how do you use historical information, external data, deal with uncertainty, and come up with early cost advice. Not that that's a perfected science, but still there's lots that has been learned over by QSs in developing that process. Material substitution, guiding clients and client teams on what's the best decision as the project evolves. Now, a very similar approach actually would apply to carbon also. And carbon and cost must be integrated in terms of the workflows. Because if you want to make a material substitution decision on a project or an asset looking for low carbon solutions, you should also look at life cycle costs or at least upfront costs of that substitution. So I think QSs therefore have a very crucial role to play in this overall exercise. But then where is the data that is needed to make these decisions? And I think that's the hard bit. If you bring in the QSs into the workflows, I think that journey and that quest will become easier. Where do you get EPDs or environmental product declarations for the products that you're going to use? Obviously, in mature markets like US and UK, probably not too difficult to find the right EPDs. But look at other jurisdictions across the globe because it's a global issue that we must address as a profession. Where are those EPDs? Where are the benchmarks at the asset and sub-asset level for all entity types, housing, schools, hospitals, infrastructure projects, bridges, roads, and so on? There are no national benchmarks that are readily available. There's lots of work that's happening. For example, in the UK, the net zero carbon building standard is about to be released with budgets and benchmarks coming from there. RICS is doing a lot of work in that area. Built Environment Carbon Database is one example of providing the data. So I think the question really is two-pronged. One, it tries to probe what's the role of a QS, cost planner, cost manager, in the decarbonization journey? And if there is at least a supporting role of QSs, then where do they go get the data? How can we jointly work towards creating a data bank that will help the decarbonization exercise to take place on projects? Now, the issue really in our sector is that we sometimes initially, especially on our journey, are happy with doing exemplar projects. So if you had a large, complex, well-known building, we can do decarbonization. I am more passionate about mainstreaming those findings, those learnings, so that all QSs that are members of RICS or otherwise have the ability to offer that service, have the ability to participate in project teams.
Yeah, no, that really resonates with my worldview, because too often, particularly in my experience, a lot of the tools, in inverted commas, if that's the right way of putting it, don't find their way down the supply chain or down the value chain, if you like, to those SMEs who in the UK are propping up 90%+ of construction companies. It really is very interesting what you're saying. I'm kind of like responding to your two points, really. And that first point that you made of tongue-in-cheek, you could have called the piece, "Where are the QSs on the decarbonisation journey?" I think you said. And I think it's quite a good point, because you also mentioned like QS, cost planner, cost manager. On this show, we have had quite a prominent quantity surveying practice here in the UK on the show, talking about how in some respects they are reimagining what their services can be, and carbon and carbon calculation is actually quite a big strand of that, if that's the right phrase, for how they see themselves moving forward. So in the future, do you see quantity surveyors, like, how are the RICS picturing quantity surveyors in 5, 10, 20 years time? Is it still going to be cost management and cost planning, or is it going to be cost and carbon planning and management?
I think you raise a very important point. And RICS is extremely involved in this whole decarbonization journey. As you know, on September 19, 2023, we released the whole life carbon assessment professional standard second edition. The first edition was released in 2017. So now it's updated. It applies to all types of entities, including residential and infrastructure. It applies to retrofits, and is hugely updated in terms of its alignment with various global standards. Now, there is a very important message in that is about, let's say, carbon data uncertainty in the quantities of work items and materials that we use for carbon calculations. So therefore, I think QSs should be fully involved. We did a survey in 2022 of our QS members globally, asking the question, what role QSs should play in the decarbonization journey? And only 10% said no role. Roughly about 40%, I think equally divided between supporting role and leading role, between the QSs taking a very important role in the decarbonization process. So that tells you that it's very important that quantity surveyors play a crucial role, if nothing else, in providing the quantities accurately that are going to be used in carbon calculations. We've also produced simultaneously, jointly with 50 professional bodies, a standard called the International Cost Management Standards, ICMS. ICMS is a high-level, simple taxonomy that integrates life cycle cost and life cycle carbon emissions. So the whole life carbon standard tells you how to do calculations. ICMS is the reporting structure. If you combine the two, the QSs can provide lots of data between the two in terms of cost, clearly, quantities, clearly, but then they can use their expertise in what used to be called value engineering. I know it's not a very good word to use these days, but that kind of process of improving value and in keeping the cost same or even reducing the cost. So that whole experience the QSs can bring into decarbonization.
I'm probably sad enough to have gone through the ICMS latest edition. I actually talked it through with one of your colleagues, Andrew Knight, who has also been on the show from the RICS, in relation to one of the things that we're doing here as a business. And I want to talk to you a little bit about that in the second half of the show. But I guess just before we do go to the break, one question, which I may be assuming this from your tongue-in-cheek response to why you wrote that piece. Do you feel that QSs are currently coming along on the journey at the pace that we should be? Or do you feel like there is a bit of a lag and we should be a bit further ahead of where we are?
Now, let's divide that question into like a couple of parts. There are obviously global, large cost consulting firms who are way ahead in terms of offering decarbonization services. either as an advisory or any other shape or form, combining with cost planning, either at the project level or at the portfolio level for new builds and retrofits. So that's clearly happening. And I'm so fortunate to have conversations with many of these, what we call our top 20 global strategic partners, member firms who are primarily QS firms. They're global, international, but they are providing these kinds of services also. The second part of your question, I would like to address it in two ways. One, there are SMEs, right? Means we can't just focus on the 20 top global cost consulting firms. There are SMEs, especially in the UK, folks with very few QSs, but providing very important services. And secondly, individual members. Are we doing enough to engage individual QS members, including new young members who are joining the quantity surveying profession? Are we doing enough on their skills and competencies, bringing them up to speed on decarbonization? And are we then producing enough guidance, enough practice information, enough tools for SMEs to also start participating in this journey? As I said, I'd like to see a day, if decarbonization is so important to us, the building in my community should also have, like we have a cost plan, it should have a decarbonization plan because it needs to be mainstreamed.
Yeah, 100%. I think that's a really interesting point you make. And so often, the SMEs are not part of the process. And I'm interested to understand how you can buy them into that process. And there'll be loads of people listening now who are SMEs at surveying consultancies, etc. But I want to talk to you more about that right after this break. Records, records, records. So often you hear this phrase in construction, don't you? Transparency between main and subcontractors can always be a challenge, and I've been on both sides of the table, so I understand. Our app, C-Link, fosters engagement and records all the communications for both main and subcontractors through the tender and contract process. That means you're going to reduce your risks, reduce disputes, and reduce miscommunication. Imagine a world where you had all of your tender addendums, all of your tender communications, every drawing, every document you'd ever created on a tender process recorded, not just for one subcontractor, but for every subcontractor. It will massively reduce the chance of variations, massively reduce the chance of miscommunication and disputes, and that's what we've built at C-Link. To find out more, go and watch the video that's in the show notes right now, and then book a demo, and one of our team will walk you through exactly how it works. Oh, Anil, you've got my mind whirring, which is a dangerous, dangerous place to be. So, one of the things that you talked about in the first half of the show, where do QSs get the data for decarbonization, for carbon generally? And you alluded to the fact that data is getting probably stronger day in, day out, as all data sets are, but maybe we're not in a position where we've got absolute strength and clarity in that data. It made me think about, so we're, as a profession now, cost planning, cost management, and absolute experts in that, and the data we have around that, and the data that everyone listening has around that, they probably feel quite confident on in their niche, in their specialism. Is there anything that we can learn from creating a data bank for cost management and cost planning, which we now have, that can accelerate us having the same in place for carbon management?
Absolutely. So I think you raise a very important point. We all know BCIS in the UK, right? Where is the BCIS for carbon data is really one of the questions. The BCIS has so much historical information, and I think it's heavily used in the UK. And there are probably similar cost benchmarks databases available throughout the globe. There's a lot of effort happening. In fact, BCIS is partnering with RICS and other global, other professional bodies in the UK in the development of the BECD, which is the Built Environment Carbon Database, which was launched, I believe, on October 5, 2023. Now, just to show that, I think, to level set, what is that data we're talking about, carbon? There are two sets of data that we need for carbon calculations. Obviously, when you have detailed project information, you've done the technical design, largely you then rely on what's called EPDs. EPDs are sort of disclosures that tell you for a given product, given assembly, or given material for the declared unit, how much is the GWP? Good example, ready-mix concrete, declared unit 1 cubic meter, what's the GWP?
And GWP, just what does that mean exactly?
The carbon emissions or the global warming potential of
global
that product.
Global warming potential,
that,
okay.
That great. We thanks. Have today databases freely available that through an API, perhaps, you can tap into and get that product-level EPD data and do your carbon calculations. The value really comes up front, where during the early stages of a project, you do not know what will it be, even concrete or steel structure, or what type of window or paint or carpet you're going to be using in your building, or what kind of structural steel will you be using in your bridge project or whichever project you're undertaking. For that early stage cost and carbon advice, you need benchmarks. Benchmarks at the asset level and at the sub-asset level. Just change the word cost, carbon to cost. We all know how that's done, right? With historical projects, with a functional declared unit, square meters of gross floor area, external, internal, whatever be the case, or IPMS, or International Property Measurement Standard of RICS, you can then utilize those benchmarks at the asset level or the sub-asset level to start guiding the client in terms of their carbon strategy for the project and the asset. If it was cost, perhaps years ago, we started sharing that cost data, right? In some kind of an anonymous...
Sharing in construction? Oh, I'm not sure.
We, without knowing, started sharing and developed benchmarks. There is like RS Means, a very popular database here in the US, BCIS in the UK. A similar kind of database is needed for benchmarks. And that's where I think QSs can play a significant role. Without the intent of sharing, we still created benchmarks. Some are actually company-centered internal benchmarks, which is fine. And as this process, this journey goes and continues, I think there will be companies who will have internal carbon database also, which will drive the initial cost and carbon advice. And if it's integrated with cost, I think that's the best form of early data that you would need for early cost and carbon advice.
100%. And it strikes me that for many SME surveying firms, it actually represents quite an opportunity. This, because you talked about, you know, the top tier consultants, the international consultants will already be starting to move towards this. But more and more clients are going to want to have this advice embedded into their early cost advice as well, right? It's becoming a requirement to have that. And so it strikes me that a lot of SMEs could really add a string to their bow, if that's the right way of putting it, by starting to provide and starting to build up these baseline bits of advice that they can give together with their cost plan. You talked before about the professional standard of the RICS whole life carbon assessment, the ICMS third edition. Just talk briefly around how both of those can actually support companies in actually starting to get to this carbon data set that we all want.
Sure. So the whole life carbon assessment for the built environment second edition, very simply put, is the how-to guide. It provides a very robust, consistent, data-driven, open methodology for doing carbon assessments for new builds, for retrofits, for infrastructure projects, for building projects. So it's a globally renowned, really a leading methodology, high-level principles and practices. So if you're a QS, you pick that up, and if you have deep interest in doing decarbonization for a project, it'll guide you from how to set the system boundaries, how to look at the various modules that are used in the ISO and EN standards and BSI standards about embodied carbon, operational carbon, user carbon, all those definitions. The ICMS is a reporting framework. It's a reporting framework not just for carbon calculations, but for cost also, because we have integrated the taxonomy in such a way that for substructure of a building, you can report cost, life cycle cost, and the life cycle carbon emissions. you would say why. The reason for that is, if you want to benchmark, if you want to develop a database of carbon benchmarks, you need a unified, agreed, high-level taxonomy. Because if I report my projects differently from the way you report your projects differently for carbon also, it's going to be very difficult to have publicly established targets, budgets, and benchmarks. So for that purpose, ICMS fits very well with the WLCA. One is how to measure. The second is how to report. And together, if we had the third piece, which are those benchmark databases, in a very simplistic form, you can now begin doing decarbonization calculations on your projects and assets.
And the important thing being, particularly with the ICMS, the clue is in the name, isn't it? The international standard, so that you're actually putting that across different regions, different states, if you like, so that everyone is actually reporting on the same thing. You talked about decarbonizing assets and fundamentally shifting towards a whole of life world view. Now, I could give you my best guess at what I think a whole of life worldview means, but I am sure you are far more eloquent than I am. And well, I know for a fact that you have already been listening to you for the last half an hour. Could you describe what you mean by a whole of life worldview, or what the RICS means by it?
Sure, I'll give it a try. So in cost, we have largely as a sector escaped by taking first cost approach. Construction, and I just mean the construction process, generally has been treated by the overall development cycle of buildings and infrastructure as a black box. Okay, it costs about 10%. It's full of problems. There are going to be a lot of inefficiencies. Let them deal with it. Put them in a box. And then at the end of the day, we'll get a product or an asset which we'll deal with for 50 years, 120 years down the road. For cost, it could work because you can still select somebody based on the lowest cost, maybe do some more adjustments, incremental changes. But for carbon, that's not going to work, because if I'm going to put in a window and I'm going to calculate its embodied carbon and pick a window that has the lowest embodied carbon, maybe I'm making a mistake, because the operational carbon, the operational cost may be higher, because there is a trade-off, or at least these need to be balanced. So maybe there is a need to spend a little bit more money, have a higher embodied carbon window, but over the life of the project, the asset, the operational carbon is low, therefore maybe there is a trade-off or a benefit. If you were to just do embodied carbon calculations, which is a great starting point, which I call a giant baby step, that's fine. But eventually, to decarbonize, we will have to take on a whole-of-life approach to both cost and carbon. Calculate how much money will it cost to replace that window for its whatever is the period, 100 years, 120 years, 50 years, whatever is given in our standard. How many times you're going to intervene, replace it, what's the cost and embodied carbon during those interventions, and how much is the operational carbon. Without doing this kind of calculation, a client really is not optimizing for cost and carbon. So if we truly want to undertake decarbonization, we will have to shift towards a whole-of-life view. Obviously, for PFI projects or PPP projects, public-private partnership projects, you do this, right? So whereas for design-build also, you could probably do this. But in a traditional lump-sum procurement approach, maybe that's where things get fragmented a little bit.
I think what I find quite difficult to picture myself, and again, I'm just going to hone in on the SME sector when it comes to this whole of life worldview, because my question would be, are clients actually thinking themselves with this? You talked about 50 years, 60 years, 120 years, I think you even went to. Are clients themselves thinking about this whole of life worldview? Or are they actually thinking about the initial cost of that asset or the medium term cost of that asset? You know, as investors, are clients actually adopting this whole of life worldview? And you might tell me more and more are, but I'm guessing that's in the upper echelons of investment. And then I'm just reflecting on some of the SME type projects that I know where it wouldn't even be a consideration, if that makes sense. And that's probably making your toes curl, but I think that is actually just a reality of the state of play. How does that make you feel?
Oh, it's 100% true. Because I've done my own unscientific study. I spoke to member firms and said, do you do life cycle costing? You know what? The answer generally is rarely. Not most clients want it right now, but eventually, and that's the difficult bit. Our sector has a spectrum. We have single family homes that are going to be constructed and sold to the end user, the home buyer. Do we really want to do a whole life approach to that kind of a procurement arrangement? Versus a large global player who has a portfolio of assets and they are concerned about how it will pan out in 10, 15, 20 years with regulation changing, with lots of targets being set. So it's a spectrum. The whole industry shifting in that direction is going to take time, but I think we better begin thinking about it and implementing wherever, in whichever part of that spectrum it is possible. For example, New York, close to where I live, has a local law 97, which has passed in 2024. If your building doesn't meet the carbon budget, you're going to be financially penalized and you'll have to pay. In that instance, now you have to start doing whole life calculations, because without that, you will not be able to show that you are achieving the carbon targets that are there. So as a profession, we got to start talking about it. Many people are already using it, but you're right. There's a spectrum of professionals, companies, and projects where it's still a distant dream.
But this is something which is happening, and as ever, it will find its way to you and your small projects. So to start preparing for it and thinking for it right now is absolutely essential, right? Because this is coming down the line. Like you've just said, in New York, there's a 2024 regulation coming in. It will be similar in different areas. One thing I was reading this morning, Anil, when we were preparing for this conversation, was your piece called "Did We Miss the Fourth Industrial Revolution?" Which I think is all about the fact that, well, the World Economic Forum wrote, didn't they, that the construction industry has been slow to adopt new technologies and processes over the last 50 years and has undergone no fundamental change, which I found a bit difficult to stomach. But could you just talk about that article briefly?
So I think, obviously, it was a controversial topic or a title to just get the discussion going. Again, it's a very mixed picture. You know, if I just immerse myself in the context startup world, I am on cloud nine. Means I'm just really amazed at the things that are happening with AI, with decarbonization, with data standards, and various other apps and products that are being produced. But then I go to a small firm, a QS firm, and ask them, are you using BIM? Generally, the answer is no. We do not use building information modeling. And you said that early on, that there's a huge difference between upstream processes and downstream processes. And that's where NEMA, for example, wants to move away from BIM and say information management, because BIM shouldn't be just 3D modeling. It's about information management processes. So that's one area where, again, you will see a change between large companies, large contractors, large consultants, big projects versus downstream processes, practices, and team members who are still not fully using the tools available, the technology that's available as part of Industry 4.0. The second issue that I wanted to really raise is that we are very good as a sector to do what somebody wrote here, an article called "Take It One at a Time" approach. So when we say we're going to do lean practices, a team is going to be formed in the organization and they'll look at lean practices.
Don't talk to us about anything else.
Yeah. So then BIM, lean, green, they become again clusters or pockets or fragmented silos. Industry 4.0 is that glue actually, which connects all these technologies. You have a technology layer, keep that separate, but address your people process issues also, and think of the holistic benefits. And mostly And more importantly, I also wanted to promote my book that I've written, which is called Construction 4.0, co-edited with some of my colleagues here in the US and UK, which talks about these issues. That if as a large organization or as a sector, we really want to embrace Industry 4.0 or now Industry 5.0, we need to look at all the tools and technologies available, look at the use cases, apply people and processes in a holistic fashion, and not just carried away by an initiative that is lean or BIM or green. Look at what can help we do in a very connected way.
No, absolutely. And I will share the details of that book in the show notes. We'll talk about that shortly, and it'll just before we close out. You kind of crescendoed me there into my final question, which is your optimism about the future and the pace of change. You're a ConTech enthusiast. You've been involved in construction technology in the past. You're now involved in kind of setting the standard for an organization as large as the RSS. How do you feel about the future?
Overall, I'm very optimistic. I'm very, very looking forward to all the developments. As you can tell, I've done this for some time. There were days when I would walk into a subcontractor's office, and even if I uttered the word artificial neural network, you know, I'll be walked out of that office not so politely.
And you're not being worn out of it now.
No, means it is amazing in some ways that the construction companies are ahead in terms of use of technology than some maybe even university researchers, think tanks. The appetite, at least in medium to large firms, is amazing. They would not stop you from discussing an innovation. There's no more obstacles or barriers, at least at the top level of an organization, into looking at large language models. If 5 years ago you went and said, hey, we'll train something for your organization, we will not steal your data, I tell you, nobody will listen to you. But today, if you said we can do magic with generative AI or other technologies, you will definitely have an audience. So I think that definitely overall paints a very optimistic picture. I think the only two other areas where we still need to pay attention, obviously, and we have said it several times, is SMEs. And then secondly, I think skills and competencies. Are, especially for RICS, are our skills and competencies framework keeping track with what's happening in the real world in terms of sustainability, in terms of AI, in terms of other tools that folks like you are developing, deploying, and showing that there are benefits of using these technologies. So I think we need to still address those, and that what tempers the optimism a little bit, but overall I think I'm very optimistic.
Well, that's amazing to hear. And you know, I personally, and long-time listeners of this show will know this, believe that your point about the SMEs and reaching out to the SMEs, educating the SMEs, and bringing them with you on the journey is such a big chunk of the battle. That was my entire experience is SME. And to me, that point alone is if we can turn the screw on that and make real change, then we can make real change across the entire industry. But it's been absolutely amazing talking to you, Anil. I feel like, you know, in these shows, they're not always the most typical shows here. Sometimes we go really QS-y, but this is almost just spotlighting an issue where I don't have that much personal experience or knowledge of, and that I'm sure some of our listeners will be the same. But I guess that's part of the journey, isn't it? Bringing so many more people into an understanding of what's going on, the systems that you guys are putting in place, and all of those bits and pieces. Is there anything that you wanted to add?
No, I think I really enjoyed our conversation. And I'm, as I said, looking forward to staying current, because that's another thing. I'm a RICS member also. Every day there's something new to learn, which amazes me. So I think if we all stay current and participate in this journey, it'll be an amazing journey.
100%. And I will be sharing your details in the show notes. Thank you for coming on the show, Anil. And I will speak to everybody else next week. Anil, I'll speak to you later. Cheers.
Thank you.